Okay, so I changed my title to make it a little bit more exotic. This is work with Oleg Newton, and also based on seminal conversations with Jordi Morales today. Okay, so there are various different ideas for how to produce the S-stars. Some of them were discussed yesterday. So an example of an idea that Alice Quillen and I worked on was that you have a binary star come in close to Sagittarius star and get ripped apart. And another idea is that you have an intermediate mass black hole with a big cluster around it, and some of these stars get ripped off, and then they lose a lot of energy and they go into orbit around Sagittarius star. And then there's other ideas as well, but the majority of these ideas have in common that either in the process of ripping in the binary star, there's one star that's loses a lot of energy and goes into orbit, and another star that's gains energy and could be knocked out of the galaxy. In this other case, well, because there's one star that happens to lose energy, doesn't mean that there is necessarily another one that gains energy, but the same process will sort of automatically produce these rocket stars. The only thing that would produce S stars that would not produce rocket stars is some kind of dissipative process, either dissipation of gas that leads to formation of stars in situ in the galactic center, or some sort of multiple scattering that brings it to the galactic center by a slow process. But in any event, generically, processes that produce S stars also produce rocket stars. However, the opposite is true always. Processes that produce rocket stars always produce S stars, because whatever it is that causes these stars to gain energy can equally well cause them to lose energy. And that's because rocket stars can only be produced in a single scattering. So there's only one rocket star discovered so far. This is the Brown et al. Star, which is leaving the galaxy at 800 kilometers per second. But there could be more. And so the point of this talk is to understand the connection between these two types of stars and to see what we can do with them, how we can use them. All right, so this transparency is here to show you that I can put up as many confusing equations on one transparency as anybody else. And the bottom line is that for this rocket star, which it has been discovered, which is either at 40 or 70 kiloparsecs, depending on what you think its intrinsic luminosity is, it should have a transverse motion of about 1 milliarcsecond per year. And it doesn't have much transverse motion because, assuming a spherical potential for the galaxy. It doesn't have much transverse motion because it's so far away, and it's coming out of the galactic center, and compared to 50 kiloparsecs, we're close to the galactic center. But anyway, it is measurable with HST, and in fact, there was a proposal, I don't know if it's successful, to observe it with HST. So this is showing for this star, the star is constrained to reproduce the radial velocity that we see, but then two different potentials are considered. So the potential of the galaxy is not necessarily and probably is not spherical, and this leads to different motion as the star leaves the galactic center and reaches this 50, or in this case 40 kiloparsecs, the assumed distance. You see the various different components are moving slightly. So the radial velocity is converging because it has to reproduce the observed radial velocity measurement, but the perpendicular motion in these different models is different. And so that leads to the possibility that you might be able to measure something about the potential of the galaxy based on making proper motion measurements. So this is showing for the two different distances for this one rocket star. So this is 70 kiloparsecs and this is 40 kiloparsecs. And these dots here represent various different models of the galactic potential. They represent axis ratios. So they go from 1:1 to 2:1, in the various different directions for these red, green, and blue dots. So what you can see is that the proper motions measured, this is in milliarcseconds per year, so the proper motions might deviate by a couple of hundred microarcseconds per year, depending on what exactly is the correct galactic model. And so you might be able to figure out about the potential of the galaxy simply by measuring the proper motion. So in this case, there were two classes of models. One was assuming it was a main sequence star, very young, and the other one assuming it was a horizontal branch star, which the authors of this paper couldn't distinguish between. But in general, you might worry that you wouldn't be able to figure out the distance at all. And then, so this line here shows the all the different models for a for all the different distances for a single model, which is the historically symmetric one. So then, if you were taking into account that you didn't have any information about the distance at all, then these green dot or red dot models and the green dot models and the blue dot models would all be equally good because they would all fit the data, assuming that you just adjusted the distance. So that's kind of a problem with this. But in any event, you could distinguish among these classes of models. And that's what I'm going to show in the next transparency. So this shows assuming no distance at all. And this is for this one rocket star. And so you see, well, this is assuming that this is the true model of the galaxy and that there was a measurement made with 50 microarc second per year precision, which I'll get to in a second of what that's going to require. But anyway, if you could do that, then this is the one sigma interval. And so these models would be acceptable. And then these other models would become gradually unacceptable. And this is at, assuming that it's at 40 kiloparsecs. Well, 50 microarc seconds per year is difficult to achieve. So it's would require a very large number of measurements by ACS. But it would be straightforward to achieve with SIM, which could get down to 4 microarc seconds if you put in enough time. So that's, this is certainly feasible to do. So then we considered how you could break that degeneracy. And the way you can do it is by looking off in another direction. So then you have to find another rocket star. Here's our one rocket star, and here's a hypothetical another rocket star, which has been found in a direction which I guess is separated by 45 degrees. And it's a similar distance. And then this was the contours we had before, and then here are some other contours. And so you see that based on that, you do two things. First of all, you narrow it down to a much smaller range of possible galactic halo models. And the second thing is that you actually fix the distance. Because in the first model, all these lines here, all these models corresponded to different distances. And now we know it's this model, and so it's also this distance. So you fix both the distance and the model simultaneously. Of course, in this case, we've happened to pick out a star that was an especially good place to look. If you pick out another star, which is also, this one's separated by 30 degrees, but in galactic latitude, it provides no additional information. And then in various other cases, you get partial degeneracy. So this would be okay, but not as quite as good. And then it could be that you look at stars that are farther away. So in this case, the star might actually be at 70 kiloparsecs, in which case the proper motions get bigger, and so for the same errors, the fractional proper motion error gets, proper motions get smaller, so the fractional proper motion error gets bigger. So that's only two parameters that I was considering there. Those are the axis, so there's three axes of the halo, but one of them is fixed by the rotation curve. And so the relative axis ratios, there's two of them. But that assumed that these axes are aligned with the cardinal coordinates in the galaxy, namely that is aligned along the direction of where the sun is. And since the sun's going around the galaxy, well, the halo probably isn't rotating that fast, it would be good luck to have it perfectly aligned. So it might not be aligned. So this diagram, possibly not all that informative, but this is showing one of these ratios going from 0.5 to 1, and then the angle of rotation of the halo. So still assuming that the halo is aligned with the galactic plane, but allowing it to be rotated at any angle theta. And these dots, so it goes from black, red, yellow, green, cyan, blue. And what this shows is that at least in these initial things that we've done, and this is assuming that we know the distance, that there's the chi-square pattern. So it's the chi-square of 0 is black, and then a half is red, and 1 is yellow. So it's really, looks like some kind of eye test or something. The pattern doesn't seem very clear, but in any event, this is something we have to work out in the future. So that, So let's review the situation from the standpoint of parameter counting. If we had a model with only two parameters, let's say if we knew that the halo was lined up with this, with the sun, and we had two rocket stars, we'd have six measurements, that is to say two radial velocities and four proper motions. We have these two halo parameters, and then we're left with four things that we can measure, which are four star parameters, namely two distances and two launch times. And so if we consider more general models and hoping that that eye test thing can be worked out eventually, then there'll be five parameters. So what are the five parameters? They're the axis ratios, and then there are three angles of the halo ellipsoid. So it's rotated once in the plane and then two other angles. So there's five altogether. And so if you guys could find five rocket stars, you do the same thing, you get five halo parameters, and plus you get all these parameters for the stars. And if you get more than five rocket stars, then, you know, assuming you didn't have get too carried away with how you're parameterizing your halo, then you'd have several degrees of degeneracy. So what do you do with all this? So first of all, you get the distance to these stars, and so you get their luminosity and their spectral class, just from the photometry of them. And you also get the launch time. And so if you had many such rocket stars, then you'd get many individual launch times. You could figure out correlations between launch times. And the situation with these rocket stars has moved from the present day situation, which was like the Kuiper Belt 15 years ago when people first discovered eight Kuiper Belt objects, to today when we have 100 Kuiper Belt objects, and we can start to figure out the patterns of eccentricity and so forth. So these different launch times, they might all be launched at once due to some infall of a cluster that just spit out a whole bunch of rocket stars, or they might have a series of periodic ones because we can see these over the course of 50 million years, or perhaps more, 100 million years in terms of reconstruction of what was happening in the galactic center. And if binary disruptions were the cause of rocket stars, then we might actually even be able to associate individual stars in the galactic center with the rocket stars. So how are we going to find these rocket stars? Three ways. So I prepared a list of good ideas first, and here's my list of waiting for more entries. Then I thought of one bad idea, which then I realized from talking to Yuri Levin might not be so bad. Wait for Gaia. Now the reason why I say this is a bad idea is that these rocket stars at 50 kiloparsecs have these proper motions which are actually too small. First of all, they're indistinguishable from halo stars anyway, and they're kind of, I don't know, they're sort of measurable by Gaia, but they don't really help you distill anything out. But Yuri pointed out that there'd be other rocket stars. So these things are leaving the galaxy at sort of uniform speed, and hence there's uniform number per distance from the center of the galaxy. And there'd be other rocket stars at 10 or 20 kiloparsecs, not as many as at 50 to 100, but anyway, there'd be some. And those would show up in Gaia as as interesting objects that pointed back pretty close to the galactic center and going very fast. So you might be able to cull things that way. And so we could have this superposition here. Anyway. So the last idea, though, is to simply go out and look for them in RV surveys. So I think Brown found this star in looking at 20 stars. And it could be the next 20 stars you look at, you find another one, and we'll have a lot of rocket stars that way. Might not be, though, and you might have to go out and survey them. Sorry? You looked for 1,000? You did personally? Look for 4,000? By doing what? For radio velocities of halo stars? Okay, well, so it doesn't look too good. Anyway, no, but I mean, there's more out there. Slonim's only covering, whatever. It's about present. It covers 10% of the sky or something. So looking for them one by one is not so great, but you could be putting them in the, in Sloan 2. Let's see, I'm sorry about that. So you could be putting them in, you could have a fiber survey but that specially did this, but it'd be very wasteful because only a few per square degree on the sky. But you could like use up some fibers in some other survey like Sloan 2 and keep on looking. So maybe we will have trouble finding them, especially given some years' difficulties so far. But in any event, there can't be a huge number of these rocket stars, I don't think, or there'd be a huge number of S stars that were you know, corresponding to the same process of formation. But anyway, even if we could find five, then we could learn, you know, a lot about the structure of the potential of the galaxy. So this kind of summarizes my...
Question at the back.
No, no. I meant at the very beginning. So the question is, could the intermediate solar mass black holes launch rocket stars? And if they're responsible for S stars, they could also launch rocket stars. So any process at all that can produce the S stars can produce rocket stars. So it could be those. But I, there have been calculations of this. I think yes. Probably is tiny, but it's not, it doesn't have to be that close. It could still be at 1,000 AU and just go by it and get a launch like from...
He's talking about different things. He's talking about doing it around the intermediate black hole. You don't even need to know that.
Oh, right, right. Yes, that's right. Yes, I thought that that was what the question was. Yeah. Right.
Can you repeat the question? Andy, can you repeat the question?
Yeah. So are there pulsars with velocities of 1,000 kilometers per second? I don't think so. I think it's sort of 500.
They're out.
Well, what is the fastest known other normal star?
Well, I think it's 409 or something like that. 520 RV. But it's 520 in the galactic frame or in the solar frame? Yeah, so that you can get up a lot easily. You can get an extra 200 just by looking in the right direction. Yeah, but I think in galactic it's... Uh-huh.
Elliot?
Well, what... So binary disruption, no. You know, if you look at... I mean, statistically you would expect that, but if you look at S02 and 1A, produced by binary disruption, then Alice and I showed that you needed the binary companion to be of order 100 solar masses. And if this one was 15 solar masses, you know, it'd be going six times slower. So then it wouldn't actually get out of the galaxy. So as a generic mechanism, I think that there would be one for them. But, oh, the other thing is that the things that we're calling S stars, some of them have semi-major axis of, I don't know what, you know, most of them, they don't know what the semi-major axis is, but they're big. And so those do not, you know, the process of producing those do not produce rocket stars because, the energy to get out is less and they can't get out of the galaxy. So S02 is the one prime example of something which, definitely, the same process would not get out of the galaxy.
Let me ask a question. The distribution of velocities by this process, wouldn't you expect a larger number of somewhat lower velocity stars coming out of the galactic center, which we'd have seen?
Well, you would see them how? Yeah, I agree that you would expect more low-velocity stars then.
Well, there should be lots moving at, say, 600 or 100 kilometers a second.
Right, but how would you see them? So they would leave at 600 and then they would fall back in or something, I don't know, 600. So this one is coming out at 800. It would be lots. I mean, there'd be... This one's going at 800, but actually, in the take out the solar motion, I think it's 730 or something like that. And so if you take something that's a little bit slower, 400, it would go out, it would come back.
If you took the trajectory of the left star,
okay, so we don't care about the, sorry. So how long would it take to get back? So the it kind of depends on how far away it is, but I think 50 million years, I believe. And so that's, but it's not an X star. It's not, you know, whatever type of star it is, it's compatible with, wait, do I have this right? It's, yeah, I do have it right. So it's not compatible with 10 million year old stars, so it's not associated, but it's associated with some other S star that dinosaurs failed to observe, you know, 50 million years ago. Right, so that's why we don't see it in the galactic center. But it's, this other companion is still out there.
Yuri?
Yes. So we assume something about the rotation curve, but you know, if you got more S stars, you could do more measure, you know, you could put in more constraints and figure out that mass as well. Oh, I think that this is reasonably well known. Pick up, oh.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank Andy again.